Welcome to the Bold Brave Women Story Hour, where we share with you the heroic and intimate journeys of everyday women to inspire and accompany you as you boldly face your day and bravely make a difference in the world. And here's your hostess, master relationship coach, best-selling author, award-winning international speaker, and founder of the Bold Brave Women Club, Mei Vu.
Welcome to another amazing episode of the Bold Brave Women Conversation. My name is Mei Vu. I am your host. It is my greatest pleasure and honor to be hosting these conversations and capturing these touching connections with people that I know and people that I don't know, and to witness their journey, their bold and brave woman journey through this lifetime. I love to capture the journey, whether it's happening right now, or it just happened, or it happened 1, 2, 3 decades ago, and it made you who you are today. Tonight, I have this amazing guest that I love, adore, and cherish. Her name is Andrea Owen. She was an ex-student of mine in the coaching school, but she has gone way beyond me and had rocked the world with the life coaching technology that was passed on to her, and she has written 2 amazing books. The first one is 52 Ways to Live a Kick-Ass Life. Miss Andrea Owen is kick-ass, badass, amazing. You're gonna get to feel her and hear her. And then her recent just came out book, How to Stop Feeling Like Shit. And I love that you swear on the cover. Yay! We are cut of very similar cloth. Thank you, God. Anyway, Andrea Owen is a life coach and mentor. She is also an ex-roller derby queen, competitors and players, and she's just badass, an amazing woman all around. And also, didn't you make some really awesome YouTube video about what the shit that life coaches say?
Yes,
cracked the heck out of me. Oh my God, if just Google that up and YouTube shit that life coaches say, it's classic. It's I wish we lived closer so we can play. But now that we have Zoom, we can play. I have another idea that we can play. Anyway, please help me welcome Andrea Owen. Come on in, honey.
Thank you so much, May. I'm so happy to be here.
You are so badass. I remember, I still have that picture, actually, when we were in class together.
And, oh, my gosh.
I don't know how it came about. And you were like racing around on your suitcase. It was so fun.
I think it might be one of those like you had to be there stories, but we had to like act out something. It was sort of like improv, and I was using my suitcase on wheels as mode of transportation. And
it just speaks to the kick-assness about your spirit, your indomitable spirit, and you also have 3 young kids, and at that time when we met, things were not going well, blah, 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 and here you are, you know, an amazing coach, a leader, a mentor, and you've changed and shifted so many women's lives, so I'm in awe of you, and I'm in awe, I'm envious, and you know, wanting to grow up to be like you.
Oh, that was such a warm welcome, and I feel the same about you. You have always been such a big spirit in my life, and the coaching that I received from you back then, and I think it was 2008, was life-changing. So I am so happy to have this conversation with you.
Yeah, and what a treat. So as fun and glorious as what we've been talking about, but I think we're going to go into a really touching area of life today. I woke up this morning, and I was blessed to look through my Facebook thread, and I saw your post about missing your dad who passed away recently, and that how he had come back to visit you twice, and it's just so touching. I could just start crying already. So And so we're going to like shift and go a little deeper onto this place of like how, I don't really know where it's going to go, but it's like, how do we live with you know, our cornerstone, the people in our life who passed away, and what's it like to be you and this whole experience. So you want to just start us a little bit about, share your story, your story of your dad and where you are with his passing?
Sure. My dad was a shining light in my life, and he and I are so much alike. I get a lot of my anxiety from him and things like that, but I also got a lot of his really great qualities too. And I was very blessed in my childhood, and he and I were very close. And when he died, he actually got very sick the summer of 2016. It was actually around in September, and we got word that he was sick, and they weren't really sure what was wrong. And we were about to go on a family vacation, my husband and our children, and I wondered, you know, should I maybe not go? And she said, no, go, and when you get back, we'll probably have a better feeling of what's actually going on with him. And so I got back and quickly was told that he had a rare form of leukemia, and it was terminal, and they weren't sure how long he had, but it would be just several months maybe. So I had never lost anyone up until then. I didn't have experience with that kind of grief. I had never even lost a pet, to be honest with you, May. Like, I didn't have any experience losing someone close to me. So I knew I was kind of in for it. You know, how do you prepare for something like that? You can't. And we live in North Carolina now. What's that?
Yeah. Well, I haven't really lost anyone either. I mean, I lost a couple, but it's not real. And I'm actually really luxuriating in this conversation, actually, because I have pending loss coming. So I don't know when it's going to happen or whatever. But anyway, so what's it like, you know, when you've never experienced that, and then it's your biggest, right? I mean, he's one of your cornerstones in your life.
Right. You know, it's the term that came up for me when I was starting to tell that story was, you know, that we belonged to each other. And I think that we have several of those people in our lives, whether they're family members or close friends or partners. And what happened was I flew home back to San Diego. Home for me is the city I grew up in, which is San Diego. I currently live in North Carolina. And I saw him, and I had just seen him a few months before in June, and he was fine when I saw him. And when I went back to see him, it was the first week of October, he looked like a different human. He had he had lost a lot of weight, and he looked awful, to be honest with you. He looked awful, and I knew right then and there that it was not going to be months. We had a matter of weeks. And he was having a hard time eating, and my stepmother's health wasn't great at the time, and so I stayed with them for about 5 days, helping them both, really, and it was excruciating. You know, no child, even if you are an adult child, no child should have to see the loss of their parent's dignity, and that was starting to happen to him, and it was awful. I mean, I have no other word for it except that it was awful. So I flew home, and then 5 days later, I got a phone call from hospice, and they said, if you want to be here when he does pass, you should probably fly back now. It's going to be within the next few days. And so, honestly, May, I considered not going because I was so terrified of that grief of actually witnessing another human being die, especially my father, this man who was my hero my whole life and who was this pillar of strength to me for so many years, who was literally withering away. To actually walk towards that pain was something I could not fathom. And I, of course, you know, for many of us, when we're faced with those situations, we seek the counsel of many people. And I asked a lot of people what they thought I should do, and I got different answers down the middle. And at the end of the day, I had to really look at what my heart said, and my heart said, go and be with him. And I'm actually friends with a woman who, her name's Dr. Martha Jo Atkins, and she's an expert on death and dying. She wrote a book about it, And I emailed her. She had been on my podcast, and so she kind of knew what was happening. And she said, I admitted to her, I said, there's a part of me that doesn't want to go. And she said, you walking towards that kind of pain is what real big love looks like. And I said, okay. And I knew it's what I had to do. So I got on the plane and I flew my ass over back to San Diego and he was in hospice at that point, and he died the next day, and I was alone with him. Mm-hmm. My siblings chose not to be there. My stepmother had left just half an hour before that to go get some rest. Again, her health wasn't that great at the time. So it was just he and I, and I was playing music for him that he liked and talking to him. He was not able to speak at that point. And for anyone that's ever been with someone who's at that phase of their life, there was the death rattle, which is called, it's this, the way that their breathing sound, it's a rattling noise that comes from a mucus buildup, and it's an awful sound. And I just weathered through it. And like looking back on it, like I still am kind of like, that took some courage for me to sit through and self-manage during that time. And he died. And I would really like to say that it was this beautiful moment where, you know, his breathing slowed and he took his last breath. And then I just like crawled in bed with him. But I didn't. I panicked and pushed the nurse's button. And like, I think that was a part of me that thought that they could revive him. Or I panicked, you know, I turned into like this 7-year-old girl and was like, somebody help me, you know, come quick.
Yeah.
And he died. And then it was really strange. They told me what was next. There was something about they were going to clean him up, and then call the morgue, and then she said, "Do you want some time with him?" I was like, you know, these are questions you never get asked ever. I had never been asked the question, "Do you want some time with your dead dad's body?"
Yeah.
And
right?
I said,
who prepares us for things like this? Do we read
nobody,
a storybook or what? You know, what the fuck?
I didn't know.
Such a big moment and was so unprepared for.
I was unprepared. And it felt like a very grown-up situation. And I was like, where are the grown-ups? You know, and here I was 21, you know. like, where are they? Because I am not equipped for this situation. You know, somebody call in the adults. And so I said yes. And then on her way out the door, she said, do you want me to close the door? And I remember thinking, no, I want you to bring him back. I don't give a shit if you close the door or not. Like, I there is no question that you could ask me that is appropriate right now. Like, so it was awful. You know, like, there he was dead. And I am, you know, pacing the room. And I couldn't bear to look over at him. But I couldn't leave his body there. And it's not that I didn't trust the people, but it's a very strange moment. And I know everyone handles this differently. And I'm sure there's people listening who have probably been in a similar situation. And I personally just couldn't leave him. And, you know, now I know what people, how important someone who's close to you, their deceased body, you know, having it come home. Like, now I know why it's so important. And so I just sat with him and just laid my head on the bed and just cried and handled it the best way that I knew how. And I called my siblings.
Yeah, okay. So I'm going to stop you right here. Because there's so much. And I'm like, oh, wait. I want to experience all. I'm afraid to experience all of that because I'm afraid I would just kind of like stop bawling. And I'm already tearing up, you know, just like hearing these statements that you went through, you know, it's like death rattle and the sound you make, that a body make, and I'm just like, oh, to slow us down and feel that's intense.
Mm-hmm. And I wrote a lot of poetry after he died. And
one of the
poems I wrote, I talked about how I process through writing, and that's how I kind of make sense of how I'm feeling. And I wrote a poem where I talked about how I felt like there was a part of me in that moment when I'm there present with his dead body. There was a part of me that sort of broke off and slipped into the corner of the room. And it was this child part of me. And I wrote, you know, she put her hands over her ears and crouched down into a little ball and started screaming. And she was screaming over the pain, screaming over the grief, screaming over the terror, screaming over the uncertainty. And I don't know if she ever left. I think she might still be there in that room. And it was a very surreal moment. There was definitely pieces where, I'm sure everybody's had this moment, where you kind of leave yourself and you're sort of like looking at it from the outside in, because you can't cope in that moment of the pain of it. And you have to have conversations with people. You know, you have to kind of like send out, Glennon Doyle Melton talks about this, and she calls it your representative. You have to send out your representative, the person who can talk to the nurses and who can call the people and tell them what happened and who can sign the paperwork and these types of things. And it was very strange and surreal.
Well, I love what you're saying here, right? Because I haven't heard anyone talk about the seven-year-old part inside us, the child inside us, that this is actually happening to her, right?
Right.
We have this fake body outside that looks like 40, 30, 50, 70,
right,
whatever age that we are on the outside. But on the inside, it's this 7-8-year-old girl or boy inside us that kind of going,
right,
my daddy. You know, it's like,
that's
what
my
the
daddy.
Fuck?
Mm-hmm.
And so, And we don't really tend to that part inside us. We don't know how to tend to that part. We don't know how to give voice. And then we're like robotic, the representative outside of us are handling the next pieces and are condoling each other. And it doesn't make sense. Now that you said that, it all makes sense to me. It's like, oh, yes, we have to tend to this part.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it was not something I expected. And quite honestly, not something I even really realized until I sat down to write about it and allowed myself to tap into that grief and that terror and that uncertainty and confusion that I had. Because, you know, and the thing is, too, it's like, here I am, I'm a life coach, and I'm trained to be in situations that are uncomfortable. And I did not go into that willingly. I mean, there was a part of me that was kicking and screaming, but it's been a lot of years and I've had a lot of experience, and I'm proud to say I can be with uncomfortable things.
Yeah.
But when when it's your own, someone you love so much, and you are by yourself, and there were so many different feelings swirling around me. I was angry with my siblings for not being there. Mm-hmm. But if I really had to admit it, I didn't want them there. You know, I would have wanted to control their, I would have wanted, like, can you guys both stay in the background? And if I need you, I'm going to snap my fingers twice. You know, like, I want it to go my way. So I think it was no accident that I was there by myself with him. I was angry with them. I was angry with my stepmother for leaving and for being ill herself, and angry with my father for being the way he is, and I wanted to have hard conversations with him that I had never had, that I never had the courage to have with him. I think that neither of us had the courage to have. And it was all these different feelings and all swirled into one, and none of them seemed to make sense except for grief, and I had to surrender to all of that. So I think at the end of the day, this, and I got the word surrender tattooed on my arm 2 months later, because that situation has been the biggest lesson of surrender I have ever encountered in my life.
Mm. Wow. I'm just like having to have a moment of wow, surrendering. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, surrendering. It's so good. And then I just felt like you just introduced us to another level of surrendering that, you know, only come once or twice in a lifetime when a dear one passed like that. Like,
mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yes. My dog agrees. She just barked.
Oh, yeah.
She doesn't bark very often. But yes, it is. And I've always really struggled with control and wanting to have a desired outcome and certainty. I think probably everyone listening can relate to that. And it was, man, you know, there's really been two instances, I think, where I really had to kind of have a piece of humble pie and surrender. That was giving birth to my children and riding the wave of grief with my father, because, and you know, in the aftermath, it's really interesting when you know, I got a lot of advice, and I sought out a lot of advice about grief. And people would say things like, in the first year, it's, you know, there are certain days that can be hard, like the first Christmas and your birthday and his birthday. And so I would brace myself for those days, you know, because it's on the calendar. Mm-hmm. And I can, you know, oh, okay, I'm ready. I'm not going to make any appointments that day, and I'm just going to make sure I stay in my jammies. And you know what? For a lot of those days, I was okay. I was just fine. But it would be things like I was somewhere, and I must have been I was at the beach over the summer, and there was a man and his child. I don't remember if it was a boy or a girl, and they were flying a kite. And I got a memory of my dad teaching me how to fly a kite at our neighborhood park when I was probably 6 or 7, and all of it vividly came back, the way he showed me about giving it slack and how you have to run, and his voice telling me to run, and hearing like his, I'm going to start crying now, but
hearing his footsteps running behind me,
cheering me on to get this kite to go up in the air, and it took me down, May, like that, so it's that surrender. Like, I would have never expected to be at the beach with my family and see if someone flying a kite and get taken down by that. And I think that's a huge element of it. Like, things that I would not expect that really just hit me like a ton of bricks. That's been another element of surrender in grief.
Yeah. I've been so blessed that I've been with my life partner for the last 10 years, and he's older than me. He's 17 years older than me, and from day one, I've always said, and it sounds really creepy, but at first he really objected to it, and then I said, oh, God, I'm going to miss you so much when you're gone, and I would literally just take that moment in and just like imprint it in my brain. I'm like, this is going to hit me. I'm already start the mourning for his loss when we first got together and decided to be, you know, partners with each other. And as I'm listening to you, I'm just like, I'm panicking. I'm like, shit, I cannot imprint enough. And I cannot be prepared enough for those moments that is going to take me down in surrendering to the grief and the loss of this person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that it doesn't matter if you, and I'm not saying you're doing this at all, but I think for some people, they try to, what I see happening is they try to keep people at an arm's distance so that it will be easier for them when that person does go. And that doesn't help. You know, like, it doesn't help at all.
and my strategy, I'm not even sure if it's going to help me. I try to take it all in and, like, be present. You're going to miss this, you know. And then it's just like, oh, I think it's still going to, like, kick my ass. There's a new definition to live your kick-ass life where you get kicked ass into surrendering, into just feeling that the missing and the love, and oh my God, how lucky for you to have that moment with your dad, and how lucky for you to get to have that moment again on the beach, you know, like being taken down into into collapsed state of grief. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, but what a gift. You know, I had forgotten about that memory. I had completely forgotten about that, and it's weird how things embed themselves into your brain. And and then what's also interesting is, I came across a cassette tape that my dad had taken. We have some video of us when I was little, but that tape is gone. I don't know where it is. I can't find it anywhere. I think it is gone. But my dad used to do audio recordings, just randomly would turn it on when we were having conversations. And I was very little, and I found one. And I my husband's car is a 2004, so it still has a cassette player in it. So I ran out into the driveway and took my husband's keys and went and listened to it. And it's this audio recording of me and my dad. And it was the day before I was started kindergarten. And we were he was asking me about it, and we were talking about my teacher, and we were playing. He would play with me with dolls or whatever, and I asked him on the audio, and I said, we were talking about what we were going to do that day. We had to go pick up something or whatever, and I said, can we go to the park? Because we lived within walking distance of this particular park, and he said, yeah. So it was something we did all the time. You know, he took me to the park all the time. Both my parents did, but it was such a gift to find that audio cassette as well as have that memory at the beach.
Wow. And so tell us about what's it like to have him come back and visit you in these dreams and states.
Yeah, well, I've had three dreams, and I didn't know about, I had heard of people who had lost loved ones, and they would say, like, I think, you know, my grandmother visited me or things like that. And I was always a little bit, to be honest with you, like a little bit eye-rolly, you know, like, okay, whatever.
Yeah.
Good for you.
The non-believer that you are.
I was a bit of a skeptic. And
yeah.
I've always had very vivid dreams. And the very first time that it happened, actually, to be honest, the first time was the night that he died. I went home and had I was staying with a friend, actually, and had a fitful night of sleep and just kept seeing his face as it was when he died. So it was, that was really hard. And I would not consider that a visitation. It was, I think, just me processing memories. But several weeks later, it might have even been within the first month of him passing, I dreamt that I was so odd. Dreams are so odd sometimes. I was sitting in an office chair in a parking lot, as one does.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, as you would do.
As I would do. And it was almost like a tailgate party, kind of. But We were sitting in office chairs, and they were kind of like dated office chairs, too. They weren't even nice modern ones. But I knew to turn around. Like, I knew that he was walking up behind me. And so I turned around and said, "Dad," and I got up and ran towards him. And he was wearing exactly, my dad was an avid tennis player. And so he was wearing the same white K-Swiss shoes and white socks that he always wore, the same kind of shorts. And he had this jacket that he always wore with his shorts. And he was smiling at me, and he was holding a newborn baby. And it wasn't odd for some reason, you know, that he was holding, I don't know whose baby it was. And its face was kind of like covered up with my dad's jacket. And he was just holding this baby like it was normal. And I don't remember what I said in the dream, but he didn't say anything in that dream at all. He just kept smiling at me and kept smiling at me. And when I told a good friend of mine who had also lost her father 10 years before, who's very much into metaphysics and the other world, and she said that when you dream of a loved one who's passed and you know in your dream that they have passed, then that's a visit. But if you dream them when it's like present, you know, or they're in your dream and they're like a character in your dream from the past, then it's a dream. So I definitely think that was a visit. And then a few months later, I dreamt that my cell phone rang and it was him and we were talking and I was yammering on about everything that was going on and catching him up. And he stopped me and he said, "Is everything okay? I needed to call you to ask if everything is okay." And I said, "Yeah, everything's actually really good. I just really, really miss you." And then I woke up. But this dream that I had last night was I dreamt that I was in a house I didn't recognize, and there was a phone, like a landline phone there, and it rang, and I answered it, and it was him. And he was talking, and I honestly don't even remember what it was that he was saying, but I heard his voice, and I remember looking straight ahead and thinking the questions, "Are you alive again? Are you back? And can I see you? I want to see you." And it was almost, I wasn't scared in my dream, but the way I can describe it is when you are so scared and you can't, like you're trying to make the words come out, but you cannot actually get them to articulate. They can't come out of your mouth. And that's what was happening in my dream. And I was afraid. It was a lucid moment in my dream where I realized, I think that this is a dream and I don't want to wake up because I feel like if I can make him come back? Even if it's just in this dream, like where I can have a dream where he's back and we're hanging out or having coffee like we used to do so much. And I couldn't get the words out and that was it. And it was, but there was also a part of my, it was almost like the hemispheres of my brain were switching back and forth. Like, I think it's the right side of your brain that is more in touch with emotion than the other world that was trying to wish him back into existence and hopeful that he is back. And then the logical part of my brain, the left side, was saying, "No, you were there when he died. He's dead." And it was a conflict, and that it was just a few moments in the dream, but it was very vivid.
Yeah, and I can feel the longing in the dream. I can imagine, like, don't move, don't make any subtle movement, it might make it go away or something.
Exactly.
You know, like, I'm going to prolong this as long as possible so I can mm-hmm. breathe him in, be with him. At least it's real to me right here.
It was so weird.
Not real because he's no longer in there kind of thing.
Right. It was like a very fast flip-flop back and forth of,
yeah,
could it be? Is it possible? No, it's not possible. You know, back and forth and back and forth in just a few moments. And if that happens to us, I think, in real life, you know,
yeah.
decisions and possibilities. And it was really strange. But I think he visits me again.
Oh, that's so beautiful.
Thank you.
So beautiful. Yeah, thank you for sharing that. I mean, you know, I don't know, most people don't talk about these things, and I just think it's so exquisite. I remember my aunt, I have an 80-something-year-old aunt, and my grandmother passed away about 5 years ago or 4 years ago. And my aunt till this day still say, you know, your grandma just never come and visit me. And she's really sad about that. She's like, I want to be visited by her. And she is like the most loyal daughter and took care of her mother all her life. And for her to not have a visit, you know, it's a little shocking for her. And I'm just like, oh, I'm so sorry, you know. Mm. But anyway, I just think it's just fascinating, this world, this physical, logical world that we live in. And then there's this dream world, and then there's this beyond life world that is all a mystery to us all.
Right? I know.
Yeah.
It's beautiful though too. Like, I gotta be honest with you, when you and I first met, I think that was, I was still sort of in the land of logic and, you know, meditating with your hippies and but now it's a lot different. You know, I meditate now. I open myself up to the wisdom that is within me that a lot of times I don't understand. And that's another part of surrender. I think that's kind of a theme here on this call, but just surrendering to what might be and the power that we all have within us.
Mm. And beyond this. And mm-hmm. surrender to the unknown, surrender to the mystery, surrender to surrendering our logical side that keep trying to protect us with right and wrong and all that stuff, right? And it's so challenging and so complex and mysterious. I wanted to also ask you about one. I remember you were saying something like, your dad was actually dying when you were writing the second book, right? Which is mm-hmm. Stop Feeling Like Shit.
Yeah.
What was that like? And there's also like some play on words here. You know, like how do you know what is the feeling like shit that you should stop, and what is the feeling like shit like grieving for your death passing? That kind of feeling like shit should stay there, you know. So there's something mm-hmm. complex here that I'm curious about.
Yeah, so he died when I was about 60-ish% done writing the book. So I had to come home from all of that and finish writing the book. I was under a deadline. I had signed a contract with a publisher, and I did get a little bit of an extension, but it wasn't much. And mm-hmm. that was very difficult. I did go back to some chapters and write about it, that where it was mm-hmm. applicable. But in a nutshell, what I write about in that book is the 14 behaviors that women, mostly women, definitely some crossover into men. You know, you have some men listeners out there. But, you know, I work primarily with women, and it's these 14 behaviors that we learn to do from an early age in order to, we think that these behaviors are protecting ourselves from criticism and judgment and failure and shame. These are things like overachieving and perfectionism, control, people-pleasing and approval-seeking, et cetera. And I would always talk about it to my clients and say, we all do these things, and we think that it's protecting us and making our lives better, but at the end of the day, it's making us feel like shit because we're not in alignment with our values. And we're not opening up and cultivating rich, intimate relationships. And so to speak to the second part of your question, I wrote a whole chapter in there about numbing and numbing out. And I was a chronic number for so long. And I'm sober now. I was a love addict in my 20s. I was severely codependent. And then I was also when I started to heal from those things, that's when my drinking picked up. And I got sober in 2011. And so really that was, when I got sober in 2011, that was really the catalyst for me to start to learn to be emotionally literate. What I mean by that is quite simply to feel my feelings, because I had shoved them under the rug for 36 years at that point. And I had to start basically from scratch, May. Like, I hadn't ever learned how to do it. I was under the impression that it was a badge of honor to soldier through and to suck up your tears and never let them see you sweat. And that was, I remember you were coaching me. This was in front of the room at, I believe it was the last weekend of the Coaches Training Institute. And I had brought something difficult that was going on in my life. And you asked me the question, what would God say to you in this moment? And I said, I'll never forget this. I said, he would probably say, quit being such a baby. And you said, I don't think that that's your God. And, and I can't remember exactly how you said it, but the message was that that was not God speaking to me. That was my saboteur, as they say at the Coaches Training Institute. And that I was essentially beating myself up for going through a really hard time and making mistakes. That's what the theme of that was. I had made mistakes in my past that I wasn't proud of, and I had carried it around and had so much shame around it and was not offering myself an ounce of compassion. And that's what that was about. And it really took me until I got sober to shine the light on where I had been doing that in my life and where I had been doing this kind of like dog and pony show to try to engineer perceptions of me. I wanted people to look at me a certain way, and I was killing myself trying to do it.
Oh,
but so sure no one can relate to that, right?
Well, and what I just got in this moment was that click when you share that dream of your dad coming in, the second dream when he asked, is everything okay? And your answer is the typical, oh, yeah, everything's great, da, 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 da. And he's like, is everything okay? And somehow I just got that again. It's like, oh, for you to slow it down and really ask yourself and get into that place of not being beating yourself up or pushing and all that stuff, and to really get in touch with, is everything okay?
Yeah, and to actually say, yeah, and I just really, really miss you.
And to really feel both the compassion for yourself and the kindness for yourself and really tending to yourself that get neglected, that your dad can feel and see, and maybe that's what he's been giving to you all the time.
Yeah, I think, I appreciate you saying that. And for me, one of the biggest lessons I have learned in my personal development journey and my spiritual journey, I should say, is the gift of paying attention. And what I mean by that is paying attention to what I need and what is actually going on. Because again, you know, asking ourselves that question, is everything okay? No, it's really, is everything okay? Because we live in a world where it's so easy for us to distract ourselves from feelings, even joy, because I think it's hard for people to really lean into that epic joy. I've talked to plenty of clients who have a hard time with that. They just kind of plow right through it. And I actually write about that in the book. You know, I call it like bracing yourself for catastrophe. It's easier for people to rehearse tragedy and prepare for the worst than it is to actually lean into rich, juicy gratitude and joy. So, you know, we have things at our disposal. We have the internet. We have, you know, online shopping or mall shopping and gambling and, you know, pick anything, you know, we can use food to distract ourselves from actually feeling our feelings. And, you know, I was the master of that. I could have set up trainings all over the country on how to numb out your feelings. I had mastered that down. And I didn't trust myself enough. I didn't trust that I could actually be okay on the other side, you know, walking through the fire and knowing that I was actually fireproof. I thought that I would burn up and I would, I was just so afraid. It was fear. It was all around fear.
I just had a funny thought. I'm like, gee, I wonder what would it be like if we do go around the country and offer a workshop on how to numb yourself in order to cope with life. I wonder if people will come or nobody would come. I don't know where the state of humanity is, you know.
Oh, I don't know either. That was funny.
Anyway, so we're running out of time, and I want to bring this us to a close, and we got to touch some really big places. So help me out here. What I feel like we went really lovely and deep, and we got to experience your personal journey with losing your dad, saying goodbye to him, and panicking and being so real about it. You know, it's not the stoic, I kept calm and carry on kind of thing. And then your beautiful book and who you are and this whole piece on surrendering and numbing. It's like, oh, I just feel like they want to come together into a message or something, or I don't know. So I'm exploring.
I think that if I had to sum it all up, I think that it really comes down to what we were just talking about paying attention. And I had gotten to a point where I was so afraid of even my own body. You know, I think that our bodies are the wisest parts of ourselves. Mm-hmm. And it's funny, and to mention the Coaches Training Institute again, for those people that don't know, there's a part of the training with what they call process coaching. And what it is really is tapping into your feelings and allowing space for people to feel that, right? Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, basically, you know, we teach you to feel. Most of us numb out, check out and all that stuff, but
right.
Feel and be with what is, right? Yeah.
Yes. So I decided when we were even in the middle of that weekend in training, I was like, I will not use this with clients. Because I couldn't be with it myself in my own life. I could not bear the depth of my own feelings. So how was I going to do that for my clients? So, you know, they always say, like, you can't take a client further than you're willing to go yourself. So those are some hard lessons for me in learning to trust my body's signals and what it was telling me and pay attention, to slow down long enough to just pay attention, to trust what it was saying and to trust what I needed and to trust that I was going to be okay and that I was actually going to be better on the other side from actually walking through the disappointment, the grief, the resentment, like whatever feeling it was, even if they were all mixed together in one hot cauldron, that I would be okay and better on the other side. For decades, I did not believe that, nor did I trust that. I was under the assumption that was for somebody else. Like, go ahead, you know, I was not buying tickets to that show.
Well,
but now here I am.
Yeah, with the word surrender tattoo on your arm, right?
I
it's
know.
Like, that's so beautiful. Your message of paying attention and surrender to your feelings, surrender to grief, surrender to whatever that comes over you so that you can feel and don't numb out. It's like, I think that's the biggest privilege we have as human beings is to feel what it's like to be in grief, to feel what it's like to be in joy, and to in loss and disappointment, all the stuff. And everyone always looks at me and going, why would I want to feel that, you know? And it's like, what, that's the texture of life. And it teaches us so much about ourselves. So thank you for reiterating that message. And also thank you for bringing that voice about how the little girl inside us in any situation, especially when it comes to life or death, that she's standing there freaking out, panicking and screaming, and that part of us needs to be tended to. rather than suppress and shove aside so that you can do the representation of yourself and handling this stuff. That was just, that moved me so much, yeah.
Thank you. It's been interesting. You know, I've been sort of grieving out loud, and I don't think this is for everyone, but I'm definitely the type of person who, I think maybe I'm making up for lost time, because I not only feel my feelings, but I tell anyone who will listen.
Yeah.
As far as my social media and my podcast and in my books, but I think I've gotten the most interaction from people when I do share the really hard stuff. I can feel the energetic, almost like, in a way, it's almost solemn and some reverence almost, that hard for me to put it to words, like energetically that I feel when people are scrolling through their Facebook newsfeed and happen across something that I've written that has depth to it. And
it's a limbic system connection. You know, our limbic brain, we all are hungering to connect with each other at such a deep emotional level. So when you are honest and share your ups and downs and real emotion, it connects to us. And that's why we love you so much.
I think that, too, what I've heard over and over again from people is they say, you put into words what I am feeling that I don't have the words for. Yeah. And that's a gift, I think, that people can give me that feel that. And I think a gift that was bestowed onto me from the gods and from, I think, the legacy of women before me. And I do it in service, of course, of myself, because we all are, but in service of other people who don't have those words. And I hope that they touch other people and they're able to move through their own pain because of something that I have written.
Yeah. And your written words, your share, your voice, your podcast, your humor, everything is great. So if they want to find out more about you, honey, where do they go?
They can go to my website and more specifically at yourkickasslife.com/HTSSLS, and that's the acronym for the book, How to Stop Feeling Like Shit. And there's information about like some bonuses that I'm doing for the book. If anyone's interested in joining a free class that I have, that's all on there.
Oh, that's so awesome. And I'm guessing that your book is on Amazon and in the bookstores and all that stuff. How to Stop Feeling Like Shit. What a great name.
Bookstores January 2nd. It's on Amazon now.
Yay! Oh, my gosh. 2018 is going to be awesome for you. I see you on TV and everything. You know, it's going to be even bigger. And do look up YouTube for the what is that called again? Shit That Coaches Say
Shit Life Coaches Say. Yeah, I made it
shit
with
Life
Smith back
say.
In 2012. Yeah, Shit
yeah,
Life Coaches Say.
It is funny.
And then,
all right,
on a lighter
thank
note.
You so much for being here. Yeah. And this is Maeve Wu signing off for this week. And have a blessed week. I look forward to hearing your bold and brave journey. Look us up on Facebook on the Bold Brave Women. It's a private group. Ask to join. Share with me your stories, your life story, what you're going through. Be part of a community, an international community, and I might just get you on my radio so that we can witness your journey and learn from your process. Thank you so much, and have a wonderful week. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening. We hope you were touched, moved, and inspired by today's story. If you resonate with these stories and would love to tell yours, then join our Bold Brave Women Club on Facebook, facebook.com/boldbravewomen.